with books. The sun was laying an even coat of orange along their spines. As we came out onto the balcony, Bancroft turned to face us. There was a book in his hand, folded closed over his fingers.
"Mr. Kovach."
He transferred the book so that he could shake my hand.
"It's a pleasure to meet you at last. How do you find the new sleeve?"
"It's fine. Comfortable."
"Yes. I didn't involve myself too much in the details, but I instructed my lawyers to find something suitable."
He glanced back as if looking for Ortega's cruiser on the horizon.
"I hope the police weren't too officious."
"Not so far." Bancroft looked like a man who read. There's a favorite Xperia star on Harlan's World called Alain Marriott, best known for his portrayal of a virile young Quellist philosopher who cuts a swath through the brutal tyranny of the early settlement years. It's questionable how accurate this portrayal of the Quellists is, but it's a good flick. I've seen it twice. Bancroft looked a lot like an older version of Marriott in that role. He was slim and elegant, with a full head of iron-gray hair, which he wore back in a ponytail, and hard black eyes. The book in his hand and the shelves around him were like an utterly natural extension of the powerhouse of a mind that looked out from those eyes. Bancroft touched his wife on the shoulder with a dismissive casualness that, in my present state, made me want to weep.
"It was that woman again,"
Mrs. Bancroft said.
"The lieutenant."
Bancroft nodded.
"Don't worry about it, Miriam. They're just sniffing around. I warned them that I was going to do this, and they ignored me. Well now, Mr. Kovach is here, and they're finally taking me seriously."
He turned to me.
"The police have not been very helpful to me over this matter."
"Yeah. That's why I'm here, apparently." We looked at each other, while I tried to decide if I was angry with this man or not. He'd dragged me halfway across the settled universe, dumped me into a new body, and offered me a deal that was weighted, so I couldn't refuse. Rich people do this. They have the power, and they see no reason not to use it. Men and women are just merchandise, like everything else. Store them, freight them, decant them. Sign at the bottom, please. On the other hand, no one at Sun Touch House had mispronounced my name yet, and I didn't really have a choice. And then there was the money. 100,000 yuan was about 6 or 7 times what Sarah and I had expected to make on the Millsport wetware haul. UN dollars, the hardest currency there was, negotiable on any world in the net. That had to be worth keeping your temper for. Bancroft gave his wife another casual touch, this time on her waist, pushing her away.
"Miriam, could you leave us alone for a while? I'm sure Mr. Kovach has endless questions, and it's likely to be boring for you."
"Actually, I'm likely to have some questions for Mrs. Bancroft as well." She was already on her way back inside, and my comments stopped her in mid-stride. She cocked her head at an angle that looked from me to Bancroft and back. Beside me, her husband stirred. This wasn't what he wanted. "Maybe I could speak to you later," I amended. Separately.
"Yes, of course."
Her eyes met mine, then danced aside.
"I'll be in the chart room, Lawrence. Send Mr. Kovach along when you're finished."
We both watched her leave, and when the door closed behind her, Bancroft gestured me to one of the lounge chairs on the balcony. Behind them, an antique astronomical telescope stood leveled at the horizon, gathering dust. Looking down at the boards under my feet, I saw they were worn with use. The impression of age settled over me like a cloak, and I lowered myself into my chair with a tiny frisson of unease.
"Please don't think of me as a chauvinist, Mr. Kovach. After nearly 250 years of marriage, my relationship with Miriam is more politeness than anything. It really would be better if you spoke to her alone."
"I understand."
That was shaving the truth a bit, but it would do. "Would you care for a drink? Something alcoholic?"
"No, thank you. Just some fruit juice, if you have it."
The shakiness associated with downloading was beginning to assert itself, and in addition there was an unwelcome scratchiness in my feet and fingers, which I assumed was nicotine dependency.
Apart from the odd cigarette bummed from Sarah, I'd been nicotine-free for the last two sleeves, and I didn't want to have to break the habit all over again. Alcohol on top of everything would finish me. Bancroft folded his hands in his lap.
"Of course. I'll have some brought up. Now, where would you like to begin?"
"Maybe we should start with your expectations. I don't know what Rileen Kawahara told you, or what kind of profile the Envoy Corps has here on Earth, but don't expect miracles from me. I'm not a sorcerer."
"I'm aware of that. I have read the Corps literature carefully, and all Rileen Kawahara told me was that you were reliable, if a trifle fastidious."
I remembered Kawahara's methods, and my reactions to them. Fastidious. Right. I gave him the standard spiel anyway. It felt funny pitching for a client who was already in. Felt funny to play down what I could do as well. The criminal community isn't long on modesty, and what you do to get serious backing is inflate whatever reputation you may already have. This was more like being back in the Corps. Long, polished conference tables and Virginia Vidora ticking off the capabilities of her team. Envoy training was developed for the UN Colonial Commando units. That doesn't mean... doesn't mean every envoy is a commando. No, not exactly. But then what is a soldier anyway? How much of Special Forces training is engraved on the physical body, and how much in the mind? And what happens when the two are separated? Space, to use a cliché, is big. The closest of the settled worlds is 50 light-years out from Earth. The most far-flung are 4 times that distance, and some of the colony transports are still going. If some maniac starts rattling tactical nukes or some other biosphere-threatening toys, what are you going to do? You can transmit the information via hyperspatial needle cast, so close to instantaneously that scientists are still arguing about the terminology, but that, to quote Quellist Falconer, deploys no bloody divisions. Even if you launched a troop carrier the moment the shit hit the fan, the Marines would be arriving just in time to quiz the grandchildren of whoever won. That's no way to run a protectorate. Okay, you can digitize and freight the minds of a crack combat team. It's been a long time since weight of numbers counted for much in a war, and most of the military victories of the last half millennium have been won by small, mobile guerrilla forces. You can even decant your crack DHF soldiers directly into sleeves with combat conditioning, jacked-up nervous systems, and steroid-built bodies. Then what do? They're in bodies they don't know, on a world they don't know, fighting for one bunch of total strangers against another bunch of total strangers over causes they've probably never even heard of and certainly don't understand. The climate is different, the language and culture are different, the wildlife and vegetation are different, the atmosphere is different, shit, even the gravity's different. They know nothing, and even if you download them with implanted local knowledge, it's a massive amount of information to assimilate at a time when they're likely to be fighting for their lives within hours of sleeving. That's where you get the Envoy Corps. Neurochem conditioning, cyborg interfaces, augmentation, all this stuff is physical. Most of it doesn't even touch the pure mind, and it's the pure mind that gets freighted. That's where the Corps started. They took psycho-spiritual techniques that Oriental cultures on Earth had known about for millennia and distilled them into a training system so complete that on most worlds, graduates of it were instantly forbidden by law to hold any political or military office. Not soldiers, no. Not exactly. "I work by absorption," I finished. "Whatever I come into contact with, I soak up, and I use that to get by." Bancroft shifted in his seat. He wasn't used to being lectured. It was time to start. "Who found your body?"
"My daughter, Naomi."
He broke off as someone opened the door in the room below. A moment later, the maid who had attended Miriam Bancroft earlier came up the steps to the balcony bearing a tray with a visibly chilled decanter and tall glasses. Bancroft was wired with internal tannoy like everyone else at Suntouch, it seemed. The maid set down her tray, poured in machine-like silence, and then withdrew on a short nod from Bancroft. He stared after her blankly for a while. "Back from the dead. It's no joke."
"Naomi?"
I prompted him gently. He blinked.
"Oh, yes. She barged in here wanting something. probably the keys to one of the limos. I am an indulgent father, I suppose, and Naomi is my youngest.
How young?
23.
Do you have many children?
Yes, I do. Very many.
Bancroft smiled faintly.
When you have leisure and wealth, bringing children into the world is a pure joy. I have 27 sons and 34 daughters.
Do they live with you?
Naomi does, most of the time. The others come and go. Most have families of their own now.
How is Naomi?
I stepped my tone down a little. Finding your father without his head isn't the best way to start the day.
She's in psychosurgery,
Bancroft said shortly.
But she'll pull through. Do you need to talk to her?
Not at the moment.
I got up from the chair and went to the balcony door. You say she barged in here? This is where it happened?
Yes.
Bancroft joined me at the door.
Someone got in here and took my head off with a particle blaster. You can see the blast mark on the wall down there, over by the desk.
I went inside and down the stairs. The desk was a heavy mirrorwood item. They must have freighted the gene code from Harlan's world and cultured the tree here. That struck me as almost as extravagant as the song spire in the hall, and in slightly more questionable taste. On the world, mirrorwood grows in forests on three continents, and practically every canal dive in Millsport has a bar top carved out of the stuff. I moved past it to inspect the stucco wall. The white surface was furrowed and seared black with the unmistakable signature of a beam weapon. I should know. I spent the better part of my youth making marks like that. The burn started at head height and followed a short arc downward. Bancroft had remained on the balcony. I looked up at his silhouetted face.
This is the only sign of gunfire in the room?
Yes.
Nothing else was damaged, broken, or disturbed in any way?
No, nothing.
It was clear that he wanted to say more, but he was keeping quiet until I'd finished.
And the police found the weapon beside you?
Yes.
Do you own a weapon that would do this?
Yes, it was mine. I keep it in a safe under the desk, handprint coded. They found the safe open, nothing else removed. Do you want to see inside it?
Not at the moment, thank you.
I knew from experience how difficult mirrorwood furniture is to shift. I turned up one corner of the woven rug under the desk. There was an almost invisible seam in the floor beneath.
Whose prints will open this?
Miriam's and my own.
There was a significant pause. Bancroft sighed, loud enough to carry across the room.
Go on, Kovach, say it. Everyone else has. Either I committed suicide or my wife murdered me. There's just no other reasonable explanation. I've been hearing it since they pulled me out of the tank at Alcatraz.
I looked elaborately around the room before I met his eyes.
Well, you'll admit it makes for easier police work, I said. It's nice and neat.
He snorted, but there was a laugh in it. I found myself beginning to like the man despite myself. I went back up, stepped out onto the balcony, and leaned on the rail. Outside, a black-clad figure prowled back and forth across the lawn below, weapons slung at port. In the distance, the power fence shimmered. I stared in that direction for a while.
It's asking a lot to believe that someone got in here, passed all the security, broke into a safe only you and your wife had access to, and murdered you, without causing any disturbance. You're an intelligent man. You must have some reason for believing it.
Oh, I do. Several.
Reasons the police chose to ignore?
Yes.
I turned to face him.
All right, let's hear it.
You're looking at it, Mr. Kovach.
He stood there in front of me.
I'm here. I'm back. You can't kill me just by wiping out my cortical stack.
You've got remote storage. Obviously, or you wouldn't be here. How regular is the update?
Bancroft smiled.
Every 48 hours.
He tapped the back of his neck.
Direct needle cast from here into a shielded stack over at the Psychosec installation at Alcatraz. I don't even have to think about it.
And they keep your clones on ice there as well?
Yes. Multiple units.
Guaranteed immortality. I sat there thinking about that for a while. wondering how I'd like it. Wondering if I'd like it. "Must be expensive," I said at last.
"Not really. I own Psychosec."
"Oh."
"So you see, Kovach, neither I nor my wife could have pulled that trigger. We both knew it wouldn't be enough to kill me. No matter how unlikely it seems, it had to be a stranger. Someone who didn't know about the remote."
I nodded. "All right. Who else did know about it? Let's narrow the field."
"Apart from my family?"
Bancroft shrugged.
"My lawyer, Umu Prescott, a couple of her legal aides, the DHF director at Psychosec. That's about it."
"Of course, suicide is rarely a rational act," I said.
"Yes, that's what the police said. They used it to explain all the other minor inconveniences in their theory as well."
"Which were?" This was what Bancroft had wanted to reveal earlier. It came out in a rush.
"Which were that I should choose to walk the last 2 kilometers home and let myself into the grounds on foot, then apparently readjust my internal clock before I killed myself."
I blinked. "I'm sorry?"
"The police found traces of a cruiser landing in a field 2 kilometers from the perimeter of Suntouch House, which conveniently enough is just outside the pickup range of the house security surveillance. Equally conveniently, there was apparently no satellite cover overhead at that precise time."
"Did they check the taxi data stacks?" Bancroft nodded.
"For what it's worth, they did, yes. West Coast law does not require taxi companies to keep records of their fleet's whereabouts at any given time. Some of the more reputable firms do, of course, but there are others that don't. Some even make a selling point of it. Client confidentiality, that sort of thing."
A momentary hunted look crossed Bancroft's face.
"For some clients, in some cases, that would be a distinct advantage."
"Have you used these firms in the past?"
"On occasion, yes."
The logical next question hung in the air between us. I left it unasked and waited. If Bancroft wasn't going to share his reasons for wanting confidential transport, I wasn't going to press him until I had a few other landmarks locked down. Bancroft cleared his throat.
"There is, in any case, some evidence to suggest that the vehicle in question might not have been a taxi. Field effect distribution, the police say. A pattern more in keeping with a larger vehicle."
"That depends on how hard it landed."
"I know. In any case, my tracks led from the landing site, and apparently the condition of my shoes was in keeping with a 2 kilometer trek across country. And then, finally, there was a call placed from this room shortly after 3 a.m. the night I was killed. A time check. There's no voice on the line, only the sound of someone breathing."
"And the police know this, too?"
"Of course they do."
"How did they explain it?" Bancroft smiled thinly.
"They didn't. They thought the solitary walk through the rain was very much in keeping with the act of suicide, and apparently they couldn't see any inconsistency in a man wanting to check his internal chronochip before he blows his own head off. As you say, suicide is not a rational act. They have case histories of this sort of thing. Apparently the world is full of incompetents who kill themselves and wake up in a new sleeve the next day. I've had it explained to me. They forget they're wearing a stack, or it doesn't seem important at the moment of the act. Our beloved medical welfare system brings them right back, suicide notes and requests notwithstanding. Curious abuse of rights, that. Is it the same system on Harlan's world?"
I shrugged. "More or less. If the request is legally witnessed, then they have to let them go. Otherwise, failure to revive is a storage offense."
"I suppose that's a wise precaution."
"Yes. It stops murderers passing their work off as suicide." Bancroft leaned forward on the rail and locked gazes with me.
"Mr. Kovach, I am 357 years old. I have lived through a corporate war, the subsequent collapse of my industrial and trading interests, the real deaths of 2 of my children, at least 3 major economic crises, and I am still here. I am not the kind of man to take my own life, and even if I were, I would not have bungled it in this fashion. If it had been my intention to die, you would not be talking to me now. Is that clear?"
I looked back at him, back at those hard, dark eyes. Yes, very clear.
That's good.
He unpinned his stare.
Shall we continue?
Yes, the police. They don't like you very much, do they? Bancroft smiled without much humor.
The police and I have a perspective problem.
Perspective?
That's right.
He moved along the balcony.
Come here. I'll show you what I mean.
I followed him along the rail, catching the telescope with my arm as I did and knocking the barrel upright. The download shakes were beginning to demand their dues. The telescope's positional motor whined crabbily and returned the instrument to its original shallow angle. Elevation and range focus ticked over on the ancient digital memory display. I paused to watch the thing realign itself. The finger marks on the keypad were smudged in years of dust. Bancroft had either not noticed my ineptitude or was being polite about it. Yours? I asked him, jerking a thumb at the instrument. He glanced at it absently.
Once it was an enthusiasm I had, back when the stars were still something to stare at. You wouldn't remember how that felt.
It was said without conscious pretension or arrogance, almost inconsequentially. His voice lost some of its focus, like a transmission fading out.
Last time I looked through that lens was nearly 2 centuries ago. A lot of the colony ships were still in flight then. We were still waiting to find out if they'd make it. Waiting for the needle beams to come back to us, like lighthouse beacons.
He was losing me. I brought him back to reality.
Perspective,
I reminded him gently.
Perspective.
He nodded and swung an arm out over his property.
You see that tree just beyond the tennis courts?
I could hardly miss it. A gnarled old monster taller than the house, casting shade over an area the size of a tennis court in itself. I nodded.
That tree is over 700 years old. When I bought this property, I hired a design engineer, and he wanted to chop it down. He was planning to build the house further up the rise, and the tree was spoiling the sea view. I sacked him.
Bancroft turned to make sure his point was getting across.
You see, Mr. Kovach, that engineer was a man in his 30s, and to him the tree was just an inconvenience. It was in his way. The fact it had been part of the world for over 20 times the length of his own life didn't seem to bother him. He had no respect.
So you're the tree?
Just so,
Bancroft said equably.
I am the tree. The police would like to chop me down, just like that engineer. I am inconvenient to them, and they have no respect.
I went back to my seat to chew this over. Kristen Ortega's attitude was beginning to make some sense at last. If Bancroft thought he was outside the normal requirements of good citizenship, he wasn't likely to make many friends in uniform. There would have been little point trying to explain to him that for Ortega, there was another tree called the Law, and that in her eyes he was banging a few profane nails into it himself. I'd seen this kind of thing from both sides, and there just isn't any solution except to do what my own ancestors had done. When you don't like the laws, you go somewhere they can't touch you, and then you make up some of your own. Bancroft stayed at the rail. Perhaps he was communing with a tree. I decided to shelve this line of inquiry for a while. What's the last thing you remember?
Tuesday, 14th August, he said promptly. Going to bed at about midnight.
That was the last remote update?
Yes. The needle cast would have gone through about 4 in the morning, but obviously I was asleep by then.
So almost a full 48 hours before your death?
I'm afraid so.
Optimally bad. In 48 hours almost anything can happen. Bancroft could have been to the moon and back in that time. I rubbed at the scar under my eye again, wondering absently how it had got there. And there's nothing before that time that could suggest to you why someone might want to kill you. Bancroft was still leaning on the rail, looking out, but I saw how he smiled. Did I say something amusing? He had the grace to come back to his seat.
"No, Mr. Kovach, there is nothing amusing about this situation. Someone out there wants me dead, and that's not a comfortable feeling. But you must understand that for a man in my position, enmity and even death threats are part and parcel of everyday existence. People envy me. People hate me. It is the price of success."
This was news to me. People hate me on a dozen different worlds, and I've never considered myself a successful man.
Had any interesting ones lately?
Death threats, I mean.
He shrugged.
Perhaps. I don't make a habit of screening them. Mrs. Prescott handles that for me.
You don't consider death threats worth your attention?
Mr. Kovach, I am an entrepreneur. Opportunities arise, crises present themselves, and I deal with them. Life goes on. I hire managers to deal with that.
Very convenient for you, but in view of the circumstances, I find it hard to believe neither you nor the police have consulted Mrs. Prescott's files. Bancroft waved a hand.
Of course the police conducted their own cursory inquiry. Almal Prescott told them exactly what she had already told me, that nothing out of the ordinary had been received in the last 6 months. I have enough faith in her not to need to check beyond that. You'll probably want to look the files yourself, though.
The thought of scrolling through hundreds of meters of incoherent vitriol from the lost and losers of this antique world was quite sufficient to uncap my weariness again. A profound lack of interest in Bancroft's problems washed through me. I mastered it with an effort worthy of Virginia Vidora's approval. Well, I'll certainly need to talk to Almal Prescott anyway.
I'll make the appointment immediately.
Bancroft's eyes took on the inward glaze of someone consulting internal hardware.
What time would suit you?
I held up a hand. Probably better if I do that myself. Just let her know I'll be in touch. And I'll need to see the resleeving facility at Psychosec.
Certainly. In fact, I'll get Prescott to take you there. She knows the director. Anything else?
A line of credit.
Of course. My bank has already allocated a DNA-coded account to you. I understand they have the same system on Harlan's world.
I licked my thumb and held it up queryingly. Bancroft nodded.
Just the same here. You will find there are areas of Bay City where cash is still the only negotiable currency. Hopefully you won't have to spend much time in those parts, but if you do, you can draw actual currency against your account at any bank outlet. Will you require a weapon?
Not at the moment, no. One of Virginia Vidora's cardinal rules had always been, find out the nature of your task before you choose your tools. That single sweep of charred stucco on Bancroft's wall looked too elegant for this to be a shoot-'em-up carnival.
Well.
Bancroft seemed almost perplexed by my response. He had been on the point of reaching into his shirt pocket, and now he completed the action awkwardly. He held out an inscribed card to me.
This is my gunmaker. I've told them to expect you.
I took the card and looked at it. The ornate script read, Larkin and Green, armorers since 2203. Quaint. Below was a single string of numbers. I pocketed the card. This might be useful later on, I admitted. But for the moment, I want to make a soft landing. Sit back and wait for the dust to settle. I think you can appreciate the need for that.
Yes, of course. Whatever you think best, I trust your judgment.
Bancroft caught my gaze and held it.
You'll bear in mind the terms of our agreement, though. I am paying for a service. I don't react well to abuse of trust, Mr. Kovach.
No, I don't suppose you do, I said tiredly. I remembered the way Rylene Kawahara had dealt with two unfaithful minions. The animal sounds they had made came back to me in dreams for a long time afterwards. Rylene's argument, framed as she peeled an apple against the backdrop of those screams, was that since no one really dies anymore, punishment can come only through suffering. I felt my new face twitch, even now with a memory. For what it's worth, the line the Corps fed you about me is so much shit on a prick. My word's as good as it ever was. I stood up. Can you recommend a place to stay back in the city? Somewhere quiet,
mid-range?
Yes, there are places like that on Mission Street. I'll have someone ferry you back there. Curtis, if he's out of arrest by then.
Bancroft climbed to his feet as well.
I take it you intend to interview Miriam now. She really knows more about those last 48 hours than I do, so you want to speak to her quite closely.
I thought about those ancient eyes and that pneumatic teenager's body, and the idea of carrying on a conversation with Miriam Bancroft was suddenly repellent. At the same time, a cold hand strummed taut chords in the pit of my stomach, and the head of my penis swelled abruptly with blood. Classy.
Oh, yes, I said unenthusiastically. I'd like to do that.
Chapter 4.
You seem ill at ease, Mr. Kovach. Are you?
I looked over my shoulder at the maid who had shown me in, then back at Miriam Bancroft. Their bodies were about the same age. No, I said, more coarsely than I'd intended. She curved her mouth briefly down at the corners and went back to rolling up the map she'd been studying when I arrived. Behind me, the maid pulled the chart room door closed with a heavy click. Bancroft hadn't seen fit to accompany me into the presence of his wife. Perhaps one encounter a day was as much as they allowed themselves. Instead, the maid had appeared, as if by magic, as we came down from the balcony in the seaward lounge. Bancroft paid her about as much attention as he had last time. When I left, he was standing by the mirrorwood desk, staring at the blast mark on the wall. Mrs. Bancroft deftly tightened the roll on the map in her hands and began to slide it into a long protective tube.
"Well," she said, without looking up, "ask me your questions, then."
"Where were you when it happened?"
"I was in bed."
She looked up at me this time.
"Please don't ask me to corroborate that. I was alone."
The chart room was long and airy, under an arched roof that someone had tiled with aluminum. The map racks were waist-high, each topped with a glassed-in display and set out in rows like exhibit cases in a museum. I moved out of the center aisle, putting one of the racks between Mrs. Bancroft and myself. It felt a little like taking cover. "Mrs. Bancroft, you seem to be under some misapprehension here. I'm not the police. I'm interested in information, not guilt." She slid the wrapped map away in its holder and leaned back against the rack with both hands behind her. She had left her fresh young sweat and tennis clothes in some elegant bathroom while I was talking to her husband. Now she was immaculately fastened up in black slacks and something born of a union between a dinner jacket and a bodice. Her sleeves were pushed casually up almost to the elbow, her wrists unadorned with jewelry.
"Do I sound guilty, Mr. Kovach?" she asked me.
"You seem over-anxious to assert your fidelity to a complete stranger." She laughed. It was a pleasant, throaty sound, and her shoulders rose and fell as she let it out. A laugh I could get to like.
"How very indirect you are."
I looked down at the map displayed on the top of the rack in front of me. It was dated in the top left-hand corner, a year 4 centuries before I was born. The names marked on it were in a script I couldn't read. "Where I come from, directness is not considered a great virtue, Mrs. Bancroft."
"No? Then what is?"
I shrugged. "Politeness, control, avoidance of embarrassment for all parties."
"Sounds boring. I think you're going to have a few shocks here, Mr. Kovach."
"I didn't say I was a good citizen where I come from, Mrs. Bancroft."
"Oh."
She pushed herself off the rack and moved towards me.
"Yes, Lorenz told me a little about you. It seems you're thought of as a dangerous man on Holland's World."
I shrugged again.
"It's Russian."
"I'm sorry?"
"The script."
She came around the rack and stood beside me, looking down at the map.
"This is a Russian computer-generated chart of moon landing sites. Very rare. I got it at an auction. Do you like it?"
"It's very nice. What time did you go to sleep the night your husband was shot?" She stared at me.
"Early. I told you I was alone."
She forced the edge out of her voice, and her tone became almost light again.
"Oh, and if that sounds like guilt, Mr. Kovach, it's not. It's resignation. With a twist of bitterness."
"You feel bitter about your husband?"
She smiled. "I thought I said resigned."
"You said both."
"Are you saying you think I killed my husband?"
"I don't think anything yet, but it is a possibility."
"Is it?"
"You had access to the safe. You were inside the house defenses when it happened, and now it sounds as if you might have some emotional motives."
Still smiling, she said, "Building a case, are we, Mr. Kovach?"
I looked back at her. "If the heart pumps, yeah."
"The police had a similar theory for a while. They decided the heart didn't pump. I'd prefer it if you didn't smoke in here."
I looked down at my hands and found they had quite unconsciously taken out Kristen Ortega's cigarettes. I was in the middle of tapping one out of the pack. Nerves. Feeling oddly betrayed by my new sleeve, I put the pack away. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be. It's a question of climate control. A lot of the maps in here are very sensitive to pollution. You couldn't know."
She somehow managed to make it sound as if only a complete moron wouldn't have realized. I could feel my grip on the interviews sliding out of sight. "What made the police?"
"Ask them."
She turned her back and walked away from me as if making a decision.
"How old are you, Mr. Kovach?"
"Subjectively, 41. The years on Harlan's world are a little longer than here, but there isn't much in it."
"And objectively?"
she asked, mocking my tone. "I've had about a century in the tank. You tend to lose track." That was a lie. I knew to the day how long each of my terms in storage had been. I'd worked it out one night, and now the number wouldn't go away. Every time I went down again, I added on.
"How alone you must be by now."
I sighed and turned to examine the nearest map rack. Each rolled chart was labeled at the end. The notation was archaeological. Syrtis Minor, Third Excavation, East Quarter, Bradbury, Aboriginal Ruins. I started to tug one of the rolls free. "Mrs. Bancroft, how I feel is not at issue here. Can you think of any reason why your husband might have tried to kill himself?" She whirled on me almost before I had finished speaking, and her face was tight with anger.
"My husband did not kill himself," she said freezingly.
"You seem very sure of that." I looked up from the map and gave her a smile. "For someone who wasn't awake, I mean."
"Put that back," she cried, starting toward me. "You have no idea how valuable—"
She stopped, brought up short as I slid the map back into the rack. She swallowed and brought the flush in her cheeks under control.
"Are you trying to make me angry, Mr. Kovach?"
"I'm just trying to get some attention." We looked at each other for a pair of seconds. Mrs. Bancroft lowered her gaze.
"I've told you. I was asleep when it happened. What else can I tell you?"
"Where had your husband gone that night?" She bit her lip.
"I'm not sure. He went to Osaka that day for a meeting."
"Osaka is where?" She looked at me in surprise. "I'm not from here," I said patiently.
"Osaka's in Japan. I thought..."
"Yeah, Harlan's world was settled by a Japanese karetsu using East European labor. It was a long time ago, and I wasn't around."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be. You probably don't know much about what your ancestors were doing 3 centuries ago, either." I stopped. Mrs. Bancroft was looking at me strangely. My own words hit me a moment later. Download dues. I was going to have to sleep soon, before I said or did something really stupid.
"I am over 3 centuries old, Mr. Kovach."
There was a small smile playing around her mouth as she said it. She'd taken back the advantage as smoothly as a bottle back diving.
"Appearances are deceptive. This is my 11th body."
The way she held herself said that I was supposed to take a look. I flickered my gaze across the Slavic bone cheeks, down to the decolletage, and then to the tilt of her hips, the half-shrouded lines of her thighs, all the time affecting a detachment that neither I nor my recently roused sleeve had any right to. It's very nice. A little young for my tastes, but as I said, I'm not from here. Can we get back to your husband, please? He'd been to Osaka during the day, but he came back. I assume he didn't go physically.
No, of course not. He has a transit clone on ice there. He was due back about 6 that evening, but...
Yes. She shifted her posture slightly and opened a palm at me. I got the impression she was forcibly composing herself.
Well, he was late coming back. Lawrence often stays out late after closing a deal.
And no one has any idea where he went on this occasion? Curtis, for example? The strain on her face was still there, like weathered rocks under a thin mantle of snow.
He didn't send for Curtis. I assume he took a taxi from the sleeving station. I'm not his keeper, Mr. Kovach.
This meeting was crucial? The one in Osaka?
Oh, no, I don't think so. We've talked about it. Of course, he doesn't remember, but we've been over the contract, and it's something he'd had timetabled for a while. A marine development company called Pacificon, based in Japan. Leasing renewal, that kind of thing. It's usually all taken care of here in Bay City, but there was some call for an extraordinary assessors meeting, and it's always best to handle that sort of thing close to the source.
I nodded sagely, having no idea what a marine development assessor was. Noting Mrs. Bancroft's strain seemed to be receding. Routine stuff, huh?
I would think so, yes.
She gave me a weary smile.
Mr. Kovach, I'm sure the police have transcripts of this kind of information.
I'm sure they do as well, Mrs. Bancroft. But there's no reason why they should share them with me. I have no jurisdiction here.
You seemed friendly enough with them when you arrived.
There was a sudden spike of malice in her voice. I looked steadily at her until she dropped her gaze.
Anyway, I'm sure Lawrence can get you anything you need.
This was going nowhere fast. I backed up. Perhaps I'd better speak to him about that.
I looked around the chart room.
All these maps, how long have you been collecting? Mrs. Bancroft must have sensed that the interview was drawing to a close, because the tension puddled out of her like oil from a cracked sump.
Most of my life, she said. While Lawrence was staring at the stars, some of us kept our eyes on the ground.
For some reason, I thought of the telescope abandoned on Bancroft's sundeck. I saw it stranded in angular silhouette against the evening sky, a mute testimony to times and obsessions past, and a relic no one wanted. I remembered the way it had wheezed back into alignment after I jarred it. Faithful to programming maybe centuries old, briefly awakened the way Miriam Bancroft had stroked the song spire awake in the hall. Old. With sudden and suffocating pressure, it was all around me, the reek of it pouring off the stones of Suntouch House like damp. Age. I even caught the waft of it from the impossibly young and beautiful woman in front of me, and my throat locked up with a tiny click. Something in me wanted to run, to get out and breathe fresh, new air, to be away from these creatures whose memories stretched back beyond every historical event I'd ever been taught in school.
Are you all right, Mr. Kovach?
Download dues. I focused with an effort. Yes, I'm fine. I cleared my throat and looked into her eyes. Well, I won't keep you any longer, Mrs. Bancroft. Thank you for your time. She moved towards me.
Would you like?
No, it's quite all right. I'll see myself out. The walk out of the chart room seemed to take forever, and my footsteps had developed a sudden echo inside my skull. With every step, and with every displayed map that I passed, I felt those ancient eyes on my spine, watching. I badly needed a cigarette. Chapter 5. The sky was the texture of old silver, and the lights were coming on across Bay City by the time Bancroft's chauffeur got me back to town. We spiraled in from the sea over an ancient suspension bridge the color of rust, and in amongst the heaped-up buildings of a peninsula hill at more than advisable speed. Curtis the chauffeur was still smarting from his summary detainment by the police. He'd been out of arrest only a couple of hours when Bancroft asked him to run me back, and he'd been sullen and uncommunicative on the journey. He was a muscular young man, whose boyish good looks lent themselves well to brooding. My guess was that employees of Lawrence Bancroft were unused to government minions interrupting their duties. I didn't complain. My own mood wasn't far off matching the chauffeur's. Images of Sarah's death kept creeping into my mind. It had happened only last night. Subjectively. We braked in the sky over a wide thoroughfare, sharply enough for someone above us to broadcast an outraged proximity squawk into the limousine's comset. Curtis cut off the signal with a slap of one hand across the console, and his face tilted up to glower dangerously through the roof window. We settled down into the flow of ground traffic with a slight bump, and immediately made a left into a narrower street. I started to take an interest in what was outside. There's a sameness to street life. On every world I've ever been, the same underlying patterns play out. Flaunt and vaunt, buy and sell, like some distilled essence of human behavior seeping out from under whatever clanking political machine has been dropped on it from above. Bay City, Earth, most ancient of civilized worlds, had won itself no exemptions. From the massive, insubstantial holofronts along the antique buildings to the street traders with their catalog broadcast sets nestling on shoulders like clumsy mechanical hawks or outside tumors, everyone was selling something. Cars pulled in and out from the curbside, and supple bodies braced against them, leaning in to negotiate the way they've probably been doing as long as there have been cars to do it against. Shreds of steam and smoke drifted from food barrows. The limo was sound and broadcast-proofed, but you could sense the noises through the glass. Corner-pitch sales chants and modulated music carrying consumer-urge subsonics. In the Envoy Corps, they reverse humanity. You see the sameness first, the underlying resonance that lets you get a handle on where you are. Then you build up difference from the details. The Harlan's World ethnic mix is primarily Slavic and Japanese, although you can get any variant tank-grown at a price. Here, every face was a different cast and color. I saw tall, angular-boned Africans, Mongols, pasty-skinned Nordics, and once a girl who looked like Virginia Verdura, but I lost her in the crowd. They all slid by like natives on the banks of a river. Clumsy. The impression skipped and flickered across my thoughts like the girl in the crowd. I frowned and caught at it. On Harlan's World, street life has a stripped-back elegance to it, an economy of motion and gesture that feels almost like choreography if you're not used to it. I grew up with it, so the effect doesn't register until it's not there anymore. I wasn't seeing it here. The ebb and flow of human commerce beyond the limo's windows had a quality like choppy water in the space between boats. People pushed and shoved their way along, backing up abruptly to get around tighter knots in the crowd that they apparently hadn't noticed until it was too late to maneuver. Obvious tensions broke out. Necks craned. Muscled bodies drew themselves up. Twice I saw the makings of a fight take stumbling shape, only to be swept away on the chop. It was as if the whole place had been sprayed with some pheromonal irritant. Curtis. I glanced sideways at his impassive profile. You want to cut the broadcast block for a minute? He looked across at me with a slight curl of the lip.
Sure.
I settled back in the seat and fixed my eyes on the street again. I'm not a tourist, Curtis. This is what I do for a living. The street seller's catalogs came aboard like a swarm of delirium-induced hallucinations, slightly diffused through lack of directed broadcast and blurring swiftly into each other as we glided along, but still an overload by any Harlanite standards. The pimps were the most obvious. A succession of oral and anal acts, digitally retouched to lend an airbrushed sheen to breasts and musculature. Each whore's name was murmured in throaty voiceover, along with a superimposed facial. Coy little girls, dominatrixes, stubbled stallions, and a few from cultural stock that was completely alien to me. Weaving in between were the more subtle chemical lists and surreal scenarios of the drug and implant traders. I caught a couple of religious casts amidst it all, images of spiritual calm among mountains, but they were like drowning men in the sea of product. The stumbling started to make sense. "What does from the houses mean?" I asked Curtis, trawling the phrase from the casts for the third time. Curtis sneered.
"The mark of quality. The houses are a cartel. High-class, expensive whorehouses up and down the coast. Get you anything you want, they say. If a girl's from the houses, she's been taught to do stuff most people only ever dream about."
He nodded at the street.
"Don't kid yourself. No one out there ever worked in the houses."
"And Stiff?" He shrugged.
"Street name. Beta-thanatine. Kids use it for near-death experiences. Cheaper than suicide."
"I guess."
"You don't got thanatine on Harlan's world?"
"No." I'd used it off-world with a core a couple of times, but there was a ban in fashion back home.
"We got suicide, though. You want to put the screen back up?"
The soft brush of images cut out abruptly, leaving the inside of my head feeling stark, like an unfurnished room. I waited for the feeling to fade, and like most After Effects, it did.
"This is Mission Street," Curtis said. "The next couple of blocks are all hotels. You want me to drop you here?"
"You recommend anywhere?"
"Depends what you want."
I gave him one of his own shrugs back. "Light? Space? Room service?" He squinted thoughtfully.
"Try the Hendrix if you like. They got a tower annex, and the whores they use are clean."
The limousine picked up speed fractionally, and we made a couple of blocks in silence. I neglected to explain I hadn't meant that kind of room service. Let Curtis draw the conclusions he seemed to want to. Unbidden, a freeze frame of Miriam Bancroft's sweat-dude cleavage bounced through my mind. The limo coasted to a halt outside a well-lit facade in a style I didn't recognize. I climbed out and stared up at a huge holocaust black man, features screwed up presumably in ecstasy at the music he was ringing left-handed from a white guitar. The image had the slightly artificial edges of a remastered two-dimensional image, which made it old. Hoping this might indicate a tradition of service and not just decrepitude, I thanked Curtis, slammed the door, and watched the limousine cruise away. It began to climb almost immediately, and after a moment I lost the taillights in the streams of airborne traffic. I turned to the mirrored glass doors behind me, and they parted slightly jerkily to let me in. If the lobby was anything to go by, the Hendrix was certainly going to satisfy the second of my requirements. Curtis could have parked three or four of Bancroft's limos side by side in it, and still have had space to wheel a cleaning robot around them. I wasn't so sure about the first. The walls and ceiling bore an irregular spacing of aluminum tiles, whose half-life was clearly almost up, and their feeble radiance had the sole effect of shoveling the gloom into the center of the room. The street I'd just come in off was the strongest source of light in the place. The lobby was deserted, but there was a faint blue glow coming from a counter on the far wall. I picked my way toward it, past low armchairs and shin-hungry metal-edged tables, and found a recessed monitor screen swarming with the random snow of disconnection. In one corner, a command pulsed on and off in English, Spanish, and kanji characters.
"Speak."
I looked around and back at the screen. No one. I cleared my throat. The characters blurred and shifted. "Select language." "I'm looking for a room." I tried in Japanese, out of pure curiosity. The screen jumped into life so dramatically that I took a step backwards. From whirling, multicolored fragments, it rapidly assembled a tanned Asian face above a dark collar and tie. The face smiled and changed into a Caucasian female, aged fractionally, and I was facing a blonde 30-year-old woman in a sober business suit. Having generated my interpersonal ideal, the hotel also decided that I couldn't speak Japanese after all.
"Good day, sir. Welcome to the Hotel Hendrix, established 2087 and still here today. How may we serve you?"
I repeated my request, following the move to a Manglik.
"Thank you, sir. We have a number of rooms, all fully cabled to the city's information and entertainment stack. Please indicate your preference for floor and size."
"I'd like a tower room, west-facing. The biggest you've got."
The face recoiled into a corner inset, and a three-dimensional skeleton of the hotel structure etched itself into place. A selector pulsed efficiently through the rooms and stopped in one corner, then blew up and rotated the room in question. A column of fine print data shuttered down on one side of the screen.
"The Watchtower Suite. 3 rooms. Dormitory 13.87 meters by..."
"That's fine. I'll take it."
The three-dimensional map disappeared like a conjurer's trick, and the woman leapt back to full screen.
"How many nights will you be with us, sir?"
"Indefinite."
"A deposit is required," the hotel said diffidently. "For stays of more than 14 days, the sum of $600 UN should be deposited now. In the event of departure before said 14 days, a proportion of this deposit will be refunded."
"Fine."
"Thank you, sir."
From the tone of voice, I began to suspect that paying customers were a novelty at the Hotel Hendrix.
"How will you be paying?"
"DNA trace, First Colony Bank of California."
The payment details were scrolling out when I felt a cold circle of metal touch the base of my skull.
"That's exactly what you think it is," a calm voice said. "You do the wrong thing, and the cops are going to be picking bits of your cortical stack out of that wall for weeks. I'm talking about real death, friend. Now lift your hands away from your body." I complied, feeling an unaccustomed chill shoot up my spine to the point the gun muzzle was touching. It was a long time since I'd been threatened with real death.
"That's good," the same calm voice said. "Now my associate here is going to pad you down. You let her do that, and no sudden moves."
"Please key your DNA signature onto the pad beside this screen."
The hotel had accessed First Colony's database. I waited impassively while a slim, black-clad woman in a ski mask stepped around and ran a purring gray scanner over me from head to foot. The gun at my neck never wavered. It was no longer cold. My flesh had warmed it to a more intimate temperature.
"He's clean," another crisp, professional voice. "Basic Neurochem, but it's inoperative. No hardware."
"Really? Traveling kind of light, aren't you, Kovach?" My heart dropped out of my chest and impacted soggily in my guts. I'd hoped this was just local crime.
"I don't know you," I said cautiously, turning my head a couple of millimeters. The gun jabbed and I stopped.
"That's right, you don't. Now here's what's going to happen. We're going to walk outside."
"Credit access will cease in 30 seconds,
the hotel said patiently.
"Please key in your DNA signature now."
"Mr. Kovach won't be needing his reservation," the man behind me said, putting hand on my shoulder. "Come on, Kovach. We're going for a ride."
"I cannot assume host prerogatives without payment,"
the woman on the screen said. Something in the tone of that phrase stopped me as I was turning, and on impulse I forced out a sudden, racking cough.
"What?"
Bending forward with the force of the cough, I raised a hand to my mouth and licked my thumb.
"The fuck are you playing at, Kovach?"
I straightened again and snapped my hand out to the keypad beside the screen. Traces of fresh spittle smeared over the matte black receiver. A split second later, a calloused palm edge cracked into the left side of my skull, and I collapsed to my hands and knees on the floor. A boot lashed into my face, and I went the rest of the way down.
"Thank you, sir,"
I heard the voice of the hotel through a roaring in my head.
"Your account is being processed."
I tried to get up and got a second boot in the ribs for my trouble. Blood dripped from my nose onto the carpet. The barrel of the gun ground into my neck.
That wasn't smart, Kovac. The voice was marginally less calm. If you think the cops are going to trace us where you're going, then the stack must have fucked your brain.